The night was moonless because of the cloud cover, but through the vision intensification binoculars, John Rourke was able to survey the encampment surrounding the aircraft clearly. The rear cargo doors were open, and figures huddled there in the darkness behind a barricade, one of them using glasses similar to his own. They were the two women, he decided, Natalia and Annie. Near them, the cryogenic chamber in which Michael was ensconced was visible as well. There was time for a very important decision, that being whether he would divide his force and simultaneously infiltrate the headquarters complex and attack the encampment here, or quietly penetrate and overtake the encampment, then move on with his full force to the headquarters, that force supplemented by Natalia and Annie, and if possible, an awakened Michael. Through the glasses, John Rourke studied guard deployment, apparent strength. The encampment was grossly undermanned for its size, and this struck him as extremely odd. Once he had awakened from his last session of cryogenic sleep and ascertained that the world was, once again, at war, he had studied everything he could get his hands on concerning this new enemy, only to find that it was an old enemy which should have been extinct by all rights. The philosophy of racial superiority as an excuse for state-sponsored terrorism was not only vile, but insane. In all that John Rourke had digested concerning the Eden Defense Forces and their Nazi allies, he had never found reason to accuse the enemy of poor generalship. Yet here it was. The position could easily be overrun by a platoon of ordinary soldiers with a good plan behind them, or roughly a third as many men who were possessed of specialized training and the right amount of determination. He had those men, and the determination was self-evident in their dedication. One did not become a United States Navy SEAL or a German long-range mountain patrol commando without it, much less survive past one's first mission. And the men with Rourke were seasoned veterans. Added to this, Rourke knew the position taken by Commander Washington's Hawaii-based SEAL unit. Once he felt sufficiently confident that he could contact this unit without betraying the presence of his own team in the area, he would have an additional 36 battle-hardened men under his command. There was something wrong. Perhaps it was a trap. He said as much to Paul Rubinstein, who lay beside him, just behind the lip of the ridge of ice and snow.
Looks like it to me, John. What'll we do? Bite?
Maybe. Dispatch two men, not make it three, to make contact with Commander Washington's force. Have Washington and his men move up along that ridge and then fan out on either side. There and there. Have Commander Washington get his people in place and ready to move by four on the dot. They'll attack openly using fire and maneuver elements and a lot of small arms fire. At a few minutes before four, you'll take half of the team and infiltrate from the far side over there.
Rourke pointed to the north.
That outcropping of ice would be a good point.
Agreed. I'll start the rest of the team from here. We meet in the middle of the camp. Get as far as we can before Commander Washington's people get everyone's attention focused on them. Then we finish what we started. Have the messengers impress upon Commander Washington that we've got to strike so rapidly that the Nazi headquarters won't be alerted. It's far enough away that even in this clear, cold air, the gunfire won't be picked up. Make sure the messengers get it memorized. Nothing written down.
Gotcha.
John Rourke returned to studying the encampment. If he could pull this off quickly, there was indeed the chance that Nazi headquarters would not be alerted and there would be some element of surprise remaining when he began the infiltration. That might prove crucial to saving Sarah's life. But he could not abandon his son and daughter, and Natalia, in order to ensure that. The cold was getting to him, and he shifted position slightly, monitoring the schedule as the guards patrolled, searching for signs of electronic countermeasures, gauging distances. This would be quick and dirty, or it wouldn't work at all, and a lot of good people might die, his family included. The ready room was quiet as a funeral. As soon as the appropriate signal came in from John Rourke, her two wings would scramble and be airborne over the target in under 13 minutes using a modified atmospheric insertion technique. Emma Shaw's eyes were glued to the vidscreen. It was either by accident or because of someone's perverted sense of humor. The movie was the story of John Rourke's heroic struggle to save his family during the final days of the Great Conflagration. The actor who played John, she'd always thought he was handsome, albeit a bit pretty, before, was nothing compared to the real thing. It was the end of the movie, when the special effects blue screen skies caught fire and John Rourke stood heroically bare-chested, a pistol in each hand, fighting off the last of the helicopters under the command of Rozhdestvenskiy, the KGB commander who was John's nemesis after the supposed death of Vladimir Karamazov. The actor who played Rozhdestvenskiy did such a good job of portraying an evil bastard that afterward he was unable to take any other sort of role. He eventually took his own life instead. It was kind of sad watching him die here. The actor who played John flexed his pectorals, almost sneered at the last efforts of his enemy, the stars and stripes blowing in the breeze behind him as he defiantly stood his ground. It was really like that, she knew. John, when she'd pressed him once, had admitted that.
Events were similar, but there wasn't anything heroic about it, really.
The helicopter was coming in for the kill, Rozhdestvenskaya hanging out the side, firing an old-fashioned AKS-74 assault rifle. Missiles were firing off the weapons pods. Bullets ricocheted off the rocks around John, explosions impacting near him, the fabric of heaven rending around him as ball lightning rolled through the sky and the air crackled with electricity. Great special effects, but the real thing must have been terrifying. A quick cutaway shot of Soviet troops dying on the ground, their bodies aflame, electrical currents arcing from them. John's twin stainless detonics pistols were in his hands.
Come and get me, you son of a bitch!
Close-up of Rozhdestvenskaya firing his rifle, empty brass flying toward the camera. A jump cut to John, bullets pinging off the rocks near him. Calmly, coolly, John waited. The flag flew. The lightning rent the sky. And then John fired. His bullets tore unerringly into Rozhdestvenskaya's chest. When she'd mentioned this part of the movie to John, he was obviously embarrassed that she'd seen it. He said,
"A lucky shot under the circumstances. I have no idea where or what the bullet struck, although it's true that I was aiming for Rozhdestvenskaya."
On screen, the pilot was struck by a fusillade of bullets as Rozhdestvenskaya's assault rifle went wild. The helicopter started to spin, augering down toward the ground, the fireball as it exploded nearly enveloping John. As John made a mad dash for the access tunnel into the retreat, he looked back over his shoulder, perfect jawline hard set, eyes gleaming with pride. The stars and stripes still flew. She'd asked John why he'd risked everything to raise the flag above the retreat in an act of defiance against the men who would be dead in minutes anyway.
It had very little to do with the men out there or the flag as a national symbol. A man named Reed, a captain in Army Intelligence, died trying to raise a flag over the Soviet facility, which was called the Womb, where the KGB elite corps planned to survive for 5 centuries and lie in wait for the Eden Project. Captain Reed didn't quite make it, dying in the attempt. So I figured Reed was a good man, and a lot of good men and women died because of what happened. I did it for him, for them, maybe for me. It was foolishly reckless, Emma.
Would you do it again?
Yeah, I probably would. It was an irresponsible thing for me to do, but...
It was beautiful.
It was the next to last scene in the film, John Rourke standing in near total darkness, as if guarding the cryogenic chambers in which his wife, his son and daughter, his friend Paul, whose Jewish heritage was neglected in the Eden film because of the government's policy of anti-Semitism, and Natalia slept. John Rourke laid down his pistols. Tight shot on those, then a quick cut to his face. The last scene began with the American flag, which had started as a reflection in John's eyes, which was impossible because the flag was on top of the mountain and he was inside the mountain, blowing in the wind, the sky burning around it but never touching it, the camera drawing back and gradually encompassing more and more of the terrain as the destruction closed over the planet, the mountain itself consumed in flames. Fade to black, then the end titles began. She'd taken an evening school adult education course once in understanding the movies. It was fun, but not very practical. Sarah Rourke was played by a woman named Elizabeth Horton Dane. In real life, Sarah Rourke was played by a woman who was more dead than alive, and whom John was willing himself to die for, even though she probably hated his guts, or certainly would when she found out about the fate of their third child, Martin. John was the last of the real heroes. He and Paul Rubinstein, really. If Emma hadn't had a mission just ahead of her, a really stiff drink would have been a wonderful thing just now. The non-alcoholic beer tasted all right, but this time Tim Shaw felt stupid drinking it. He'd had 3 of them the previous night and been tempted to switch to coffee. Instead, he convinced himself that 1 real beer wouldn't hurt. As he got up to go toward the kitchen and retrieve one, he picked up the .45 and stuffed it into his trouser band. It was good knowing that Eddie and the guys were out there, keeping an eye on the house, but there was little comfort in the plan that he had essentially dictated to Eddie in his office that afternoon just before leaving for home.
This is the only way it'll work, son. I know it gives you the willies, and it doesn't go down too hot with me either. But there's no choice, all right?
Fine. We respond when the first shot goes off. And what if somehow they were able to slip right past us, and they're using suppressed weapons, and you don't get a shot off at all? Ever think about that, Dad? Emma'll have your ass for breakfast when she finds out. If you're still alive for her to get to.
Who's gonna tell her, Eddie? She's like her mother, worries too much. Women are all like that, you should know. The second I even think of one of those Nazi fuckers got his ass in the house, I pop a shot off and you guys close in. It couldn't be simpler, right? Relax already.
There was always the possibility that Eddie was right, Tim Shaw realized. The Nazis might slip past, might use suppressed weapons, and he might get dead very quickly, too quickly to trigger a round and call in the cavalry. It was the chance he was taking because he didn't have a choice. Yet things were starting to look rather discouraging. It was almost time to hit the sack, and still, no bad guys. He'd strip and get into the sheets just like he was supposed to, but he wasn't cool enough to close his eyes and sleep. If they came, he wanted to be wide awake. Tim Shaw opened the refrigerator and peered inside. There was some chocolate pudding, but that might screw up his stomach. When he was nervous, he had a little lactose intolerance. All he needed was to be farting when he should be shooting. As he took his beer, Shaw had an awful realization. He would be at his most vulnerable when he was in the shower tomorrow morning. Detail stripping at J-Frame Smith & Wesson wasn't a picnic, but the government model Colt was a snap after all these years. Tim Shaw shrugged his shoulders. He'd take it into the shower with him. Years ago, he'd known this guy who cleaned his .45 by running it through his wife's dishwasher, field-stripped to major components, then lubed up afterward. It was a cute trick, but Shaw had never seen a lot of practicality in it. In an old gun magazine on microfiche, he'd even seen an ad Colt had used showing a .45 auto in the dishwasher.
Hell, who cleans them?
The virtue of a big-bore handgun, among other things, was that it really didn't have to be cleaned that often to keep running. On impulse, before closing the refrigerator door, Shaw tapped down his pockets. The spare magazines for the Colt, a Lancer reproduction, were there, and so were two speed loaders for the little Smith, also really a Lancer. He used the old 7-round magazines for the Colt, liking those better, giving him 8 in the gun plus 14 more. And he had a grand total of 15 rounds for the .38. 8 and 14 made 22, plus 15 gave him 37 rounds. If that wasn't enough to get him by until Eddie and the Honolulu SWAT team got on the scene.
Fucked anyway.
He kicked the refrigerator door closed and twisted off the cap on the beer bottle. The beer, his favorite, was something he had John Rourke to thank for. At the retreat, Dr. Rourke had kept a case of Michelob. Better than 100 years ago, Rourke gave a bottle of it to a lab technician at New Germany to reproduce for him. The lab technician not only produced a supply for Rourke's retreat, but gave a case to New Germany's primary alcoholic beverages distributor. As the story went, the man, whose name was Balthasar Schmidt, fell in love with the taste and decided to manufacture it, even duplicating the labeling. Today, Balthasar Schmidt Breweries produced an entire line of pre-war liquors and beers, all faithful formula duplicates of the originals. There was a story going around that the executives at Balthasar Schmidt were trying to work out an endorsement deal for Dr. Rourke. Shaw didn't think Rourke would take it. On the other hand, he would have. As Tim Shaw opened the bottle, he looked into the front of the microwave oven, in which he could see his own reflection.
This is Dr. John Rourke, hero of the war between the superpowers, telling you that...
Behind his own reflection, Tim saw the bedroom door down the apartment's hallway. Tim Shaw's bedroom door was never touched, unless it was one of those increasingly rare occasions when his daughter Emma came over to spend the night. Otherwise, it remained open, just as it had been when he'd gone in the room earlier and put his wallet, his keys, and his money clip on the dresser. Shaw slowly, very slowly, turned away from the microwave so that whoever was inside the bedroom or down the hallway wouldn't notice him staring at the reflection.
Yeah, if I were John Rourke, I'd be sitting pretty in all those endorsements. Lancers? Hey, I think the Lancer reproductions are just as good as the real thing. I use them. Why don't you? Keep me in guns and money.
And Tim Shaw threw the beer bottle into the sink and wheeled toward the hallway. The smart thing to do would have been to fire a shot. But if he had accidentally bumped the bedroom door and caused it to swing partially shut, he'd blow the whole thing. This way, brandishing a weapon in the direction of the assumed bad guys, if they were there, they'd do something. They were there. Tim Shaw threw himself left toward the front room. Gunfire impacted the couch, and Tim Shaw went flat, stabbing the .45 over the arm of the couch and pivoting the muzzle right and left.
Hey, you guys fucked up! I wanted you to come visit me, motherfuckers! You kill innocent civilians and you murder children and their teachers? Come get me fast before the good guys get here and bust your ass! Come on!
Kimshaw was mentally ticking off the seconds. In about another minute, his son and the Honolulu PD SWAT team would be kicking in the doorway at the front and back and nail the Nazis between them.
Yeah, you shits! Come and get me!
Shaw glanced up over the couch, and sure enough, six men with submachine guns were coming to get him. Shaw was already moving, one gun in each hand, a slug from the .45 nailing one of the six men in the chest. The little .38 special in Shaw's left hand stabbed outward. Bullets tore into the wall. Shaw had run for the apartment's exterior wall. His neighbors in the adjoining apartment were quietly evacuated, but the kid had tropical fish in a tank, and there was no sense ruining the kid's day. And one direction was just about as good as the next. Bullets tore out a chunk at the corner of two intersecting walls as Tim Shaw ducked into the guest bathroom. He stabbed the .45 around the corner. He backstepped into the tub, wishing it were one of the old-style tubs he'd seen in period films, cast iron instead of fiberglass. Back to the wall, figuratively but not literally, he was on his knees inside the tub, crouched as low as he could. The bad guys hit the doorway, the first one playing hero or just naturally foolish. Shaw let him have one from each gun. The last three men wouldn't be as careless. Shaw threw himself down as flat as he could into the tub, knowing what was coming.
Eddie!
Tim Shaw was up, stepping over the bathtub, advancing toward the doorway as he hugged his body flat to the wall opposite the sink. The gunfire kept coming, as if there were a small war going on in his living room. One of the three ran past the doorway, blood spraying from a wound to his right thigh.
Dad!
In the john, Eddie! Six down?
There were seven. The seventh guy was waiting outside the door just in case you made it that far. You all right?
Yep. Hey, Pizza Teen. Hey, remember what you and Emma said when I told you there was a tub in the guest bathroom?
No, what'd we say?
Said it was a bad idea. Good thing I don't listen to you guys. Any of them alive?
Nope.
What they look like?
Before his son could answer him, one of the SWAT team members bent over the nearest of the dead men and pulled the hood from his face.
That guy's a Nazi. I'm gonna be the next Miss Hawaii. Just hitters. Damn it.
Check them all!
One by one, the six dead men were unmasked. Three of them were guys Tim Shaw had seen in lineups, and none of them had anything close to the classic Aryan look.
He's still out there, Eddie. Whoever the fuck the leader is, still out there. And this is either going to bring him after me or send him to the ground.
You nearly got it.
I nearly got a beer. That's all I nearly got. Get the news people over here. I want all the coverage we can get. This time, no screwing around. I'm going to call their leader a coward. Tell right on the air that he's a chicken shit afraid to come after me. See what he's made of.
Dad, what if he comes for you with a bomb or something?
No bomb, Eddie. He'll have to make a run for it because he knows he's too hot or he'll come after me himself. Up close, real personal. He'll be smarter than these schmucks. It's just gonna be him and me, Eddie.
Hey, no way!
Hey, remember who runs this fucking TAC unit, huh? I'm gonna tell him it's just gonna be him and me. Either way, we're rid of him.
Well, what if he comes
up? If he gets me, then you get on the damn television and call him out. Long as this Nazi shit's running around the islands, we got more civilian deaths to look forward to. You tell me what choice we got, huh?
Where are you gonna do this stupid shit?
OK Corral's closed for repairs. I figure the mountains near Emma's place. No civilians to get hurt. And I know those mountains. He doesn't.
Michael had been back for almost 5 minutes. After embracing him, making certain he was all right, her own behavior amazed her at times, Natalia set about reading the two printouts Michael had smuggled back. Annie and the crew members were guarding the aircraft against what Natalia considered an almost inevitable attack. The number of troops on hand at the Nazi headquarters complex was ridiculously meager compared to what any decent commander would have maintained. The material regarding the cloning of human beings and the recording and downloading of the mind was like something out of a nightmare.
What do you make of this? I mean, its existence in that computer. Was the computer just a terminal into a central system?
Not that I could tell. Looked to me like they were set up to modem data back and forth as required. But who the hell loads a field computer with top-secret data anyway?
They seem to want us to know the contents of these files. Would you agree?
My thoughts exactly. Dietrich Zimmer must have counted on one of us hitting the command tent. But why? How did he know we'd do it?
What if he knew that Martin was dead? Zimmer specified the number of people who could accompany your father when he returned Martin for the deal. If Zimmer knew that Martin was dead, then he would be able to assume that because of the number he specified, the entire family would come along, even you, posing as Martin. You did that before, remember?
For what purpose?
Put the two files together, darling, and what do you have?
An invitation to go visit Nazi headquarters, and greater urgency than ever before to get Mom and Wolfgang Mann away from him.
Exactly. And if curiosity gets the better of us, we'll all come. He will have the entire family in one place at one time.
Still doesn't make any sense. Why didn't he just bomb the hell out of the cryogenic repository in New Germany and kill us while we slept?
I will have to coach you in your technical German. It seems clear that the only way Dr. Zimmer's little mind experiments can be performed is when the subject's brain is active. When we were in this sleep, our brainwave activity was at a reduced level. What if he wants what is in our heads? What about that? What do you think, Michael?
To what end, Natalia?
What if he sees a Rourke family that is alive and well as of much more potential value to him than a Rourke family that is dead? What if he is almost daring us to come by telling us his plan ahead of time, making his plan so irresistible that we cannot avoid walking right into it? I think Dr. Zimmer laid out this data as an invitation.
And we'll accept, won't we?
No answer was necessary. Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna knew that they would. The attack on the city within the mountain at which Dietrich Zimmer now stared would be costly. The fools within it were not the ones who would exact the toll. He would. Zimmer looked away from the window and stood up, pacing along the fuselage toward the coffee urn at the rear of the craft. He preferred not to have servants attending him, as extraneous people often interrupted, however unintentionally, one's thought processes. He poured a cup of coffee into a china cup set on a saucer, the cup and the saucer ordinary in color and design. Neither was he a man of excess. When there was the need to impress with power and influence, he was fully capable of summoning all the trappings. But he needed them not at all, and for himself preferred a more modest approach to life. His attack on the self-styled Aryans within the mountain would begin in moments, and then, of course, the Transglobal Alliance forces would arrive on the scene to harass his forces, perhaps even to engage. But they did not know with what they would be dealing. While the bulk of his force would be inside the mountain, safe, the bulk of the Transglobal Alliance forces would be exposed. They would regret that. Meanwhile, John Rourke and his loyal associate would be about to attack the supposed headquarters complex. Zimmer had personally seen to it that Rourke could find it. Dr. Rourke's entire family would be inside that complex. And if the primary plan failed, the woman, whom John Rourke would not be wholly convinced was the clone of his wife, Sarah Rourke was even convinced that she was a clone, would either kill him, which would be regrettable in a way, or she would be killed by him. In either event, Rourke was finished. Knowing Rourke as he did, they had been enemies for better than a century, Zimmer was as certain of John Rourke's behavior as he was that the sun, if it rose, would rise in the east. After all, this could be the last second of eternity, although Zimmer seriously doubted it. If Rourke survived, the minds of Rourke and his family would be his, to do with as he wished.
Ah, lovely.
The play was about to begin, the invitations all neatly answered. But what the Rourkes and the Transglobal Alliance did not suspect was that this was the beginning of the final act. No one living had ever witnessed what Anton Gabler was about to precipitate. The prospect, when he considered it at any great length, caused him to become partially erect. Power, after all, was the ultimate aphrodisiac. Purposely, even though he did not have to answer any biological need, he had gone to the restroom, his intent merely to be able to see his own face in the moment before he made history, remember the set of his features, be forever aware of the power he was about to exert. Anton Gabler took the small brush from the right outside pocket of his lab coat, worked back his short hair with it, getting the front, exactly cut only this morning, at the precise angle to set off his profile rather than distract the viewer's eye from it. There should have been photographers and videographers ready and waiting to record this. Instead, there was only the automatic video camera, which constantly monitored all activity within the bunker. The button, he had made certain of the color, was red. Red was the color of blood, and of the sun when it was dying in the night sky. Red signaled anger. In some cultures, before the night of the war, it had signaled happiness. No anger consumed Anton Gabler, only passion. And the passion was not for death, but for immortality. He, of all the scientists under Dietrich Zimmer, was the Herr Doctor's choice to lead the project, and the obvious choice to execute it in this final moment. The Herr Doctor saw the potential in him. Of that, Anton Gabler was certain. Finished with his hair, he pocketed the brush, trying to decide whether or not he should avail himself of the opportunity to urinate. He decided against it. After all, the moment was approaching when he would hold his finger poised over the button. The historic moment was one he wished to savor. Anton Gabler walked through the doorway, careful to check the door behind him, making certain that it was properly locked. This was his own private facility, and there was always the possibility that some jealous person might attempt to use it. As director of the project, one had certain prerogatives, and with these came responsibility. In order for others, younger scientists, to strive to be their best, to attain his level of excellence, the example had to be set. The rigidity of how he looked down from the heights maintained, so that they would, in turn, aspire to these heights on their own. Anton Gabler walked carefully, evenly, along the corridor toward the double doors at its far end. Armed SS men stood on either side of the doorway, and even then it was necessary to be admitted by voice print and visual computer identification. This was good, because such power as he was about to wield could not be allowed to fall into the wrong hands. Whenever he was not personally present, Gabler locked all access to the controls, to the master program. After all, not just anyone was allowed to detonate the first nuclear device to be used in 625 years.
Be ready. They're coming.
The three people with Annie manned various weapons. The captain had a caseless assault rifle, but the co-pilot and the radio man navigator crewed an energy cannon. Michael and Natalia, outside the aircraft, had energy weapons and conventional assault rifles. If Michael's and Natalia's supposition, based on the intelligence data Michael had gathered within the Nazi camp, were correct, this attack wouldn't be much. But any time enemy personnel were advancing toward her in vastly superior numbers, she took it seriously. Beside her sandbagged positions, which would be of little use in the event of a direct hit from an energy weapon, lay the Detonic Scoremaster. If she needed a handgun under these circumstances, it would only be because the enemy had closed on her position. Under such circumstances, her father had taught her to rely on nothing less than a .45 ACP or a .357 Magnum. The latter caliber was unavailable to her. Annie had another worry, more serious than her own safety. If Dietrich Zimmer's Nazi forces were attacking the aircraft, that signaled that all bets were off, and her father, John Rourke, and her husband, Paul Rubinstein, might be in even greater danger. There was no way to know. She took what little comfort she could from the fact that she had felt nothing, no sympathetic pain or sense of imminent death, as she had always felt since awakening from the sleep for the first time 125 years ago. The doctor who had treated Natalia during her breakdown had discussed the phenomenon with her, Annie, and said that it was somehow intertwined with the fact that she had pubesced quite early after leaving the sleep. In documented cases of psychic phenomena, as affecting women, there was usually a link to the onset of the menstrual cycle. Annie didn't know whether that was scientific silliness or valid, but that she could experience empathic response with those for whom she cared a great deal was a fact of her life. For once, she was happy for it. No news was good news. As President of the United States, Arthur Hook knew that he was considered not only his nation's leader, but leader of the free world. The free world these days encompassed the nations of the Trans-Global Alliance. The enemy of the moment, in humanity's never-ending struggle, was an old enemy, one never properly defeated the first time. Although he rarely had the time anymore, he'd made the time for himself today, visiting the place in Midwake which was his first love, the United States Navy Center for Marine Research. It was the world's finest aquarium, because the aquarium surrounded the observers. His security personnel were vehemently opposed to his leaving the main complex at Midwake to venture out more than 2 miles to the Marine Research Center, but he finally just ordered the security people to do as he told them. And he was transported here in a mini-sub, 4 other mini-subs surrounding it and 3 attack submarines standing by to assist. The problem with being president, he had once told an interviewer, was that the constraints it placed on the little ordinary things were outrageous. Although always a reader of history, he had fallen in love with the view through the center's aquarium windows when he was just a student and had been lucky enough to get a clerical job here. On his break time, he would come to the windows and just watch life unfold before him. The glass, it wasn't really like ordinary glass at all, was designed to intensify available light, making the view without as clear as day, but casting no light on the sea creatures, thus altering their behaviors not at all. He studied a striped sea catfish, special sensory barbels or whiskers extending from its lower jaw to aid in locating food as they schooled near to the window. He envied them the simplicity of their lives. Eat, reproduce, perhaps die prematurely, but never the need to carry the weight of the species on their shoulders. He carried that weight. At the end of World War II, the United States and its allies made two horrendous mistakes. First, the advice of the generals should have been taken. The German army, the Wehrmacht, rearmed and set against the Soviet Union. Second, the useful Nazis, who were true Nazis, not the ones who were legitimate scientists impressed against their will or by circumstances into missile research and other programs, but the ones who were true believers in Nazism, should have been eliminated by whatever means necessary. As recorded in the memoirs of Commander Robert Gunderson, USN, captain of the USS John Paul Jones, John Rourke had recounted once during that historic voyage the story of a Latin American military officer. The officer was a friend of one of Rourke's own friends. During a meeting once, social, the retired officer told Rourke's friend,
"The problem with the United States, amigo, is that you never win a war. You win all the battles, but then leave the field. Your nation did not win World War II. If you had won, you would have seen to it that those who caused such destruction were rendered unable to do so again. You would have taken the territories which were controlled by the vanquished and established governments there which would forever be allied to your own political interests. Look at Germany and Japan. They are world leaders in both industry and finance. They are gradually destroying their adversaries from the period of World War II, and your nation helps them do this. The people of Germany and Japan would be just as well off, perhaps better off, if your nation controlled them, and your nation and the world in general would not be in peril."
Arthur Hook had read the memoirs so often that he'd memorized this passage, almost certainly a paraphrase. The message, however, was clear. American military personnel had fought and died only so that the political leaders could sell out the hard-won peace. Today, as he quietly observed the infinite variety of life, this course of past action was about to bear its final fruit. Dr. Thorne Rolvag's estimates concerning the trench, which was growing inexorably toward the east, were, as best Hook's scientific advisors could determine, right on the money. That meant that unless the enormous crack stopped of its own accord, unlikely, something would have to be done to stop it. The chance of such an endeavor succeeding was remote at best. Rolvag's whimsical alternative, a race to launch arcs for humanity into deep space, was impractical considering the time frame. Chances were excellent that humanity was about to perish and sink into oblivion. And as Arthur Hook watched the catfish on the other side of the glass, he was reminded of another quotation from a work vastly older.
"As ye sow, therefore also shall ye reap."
Gruppenführer Kroenberg's eyes were gray-blue, but the most extraordinary feature about him was his head itself. Shaven, the skin was very tight, and according to the intelligence dossier, it was possible to see a vein occasionally pulse beneath it. Kroenberg's English, normally accented, could be perfect when the need arose. Disguise was something he had been known to employ on at least two occasions. In his 50s, he was tall, vigorous, and, judging by the results of his activities on behalf of the SS, exceedingly intelligent and remarkably clever. That he was ruthless seemed obvious, but there was always a pattern to his activities. Kroenberg, it seemed, was as cold-blooded a killer as had ever been born, but only killed out of necessity, as he interpreted it. Nothing suggested a pathological bloodlust. Manfred Kohl's voice interrupted James Darkwood's thoughts.
"Remember that sleeve pistol he carries, hmm?"
7.65mm muscle group activator or something like that. I remember. You just remember, we're talking making a deal, not a hit, unless it comes to that.
I was not happy that we were volunteered for this mission, James.
I know.
I am reminded of the words of Winston Churchill when he was speaking of Joseph Stalin to the effect that he would make an alliance with the devil in order to defeat Hitler.
And you think asking Kronberg for help and offering him a deal in exchange is making a pact with the devil?
I think it is possibly so. You are an American, I am German. For me, perhaps, the concept of a Nazi is more real. And this man is a Nazi.
If we defeat Eden and Zimmer's Nazis, if we can save a lot of lives by doing this, or even one life, it's worth it, maybe. Hell, I don't know.
Cole shook his head, then started moving again, Darkwood falling in beside the taller man. They had been enjoying their first few hours of R&R after a dangerous mission in Eden City and a difficult escape when they were hunted down by New Germany military police and told to report to the office of Generaloberst Nauert as quickly as possible. In the next breath, they were told that transportation would be provided and to climb into the car. Generaloberst Franz Nauert was New Germany's chief intelligence officer, one of the real powers in the Transglobal Alliance's intelligence hierarchy, and at once respected and reviled. He was respected for his personal toughness, that he had risen through the ranks, had as much field agent experience behind him as anyone, and more than most. Franz Nauert was reviled for the assignments he sometimes made. This turned out to be one of them. In khaki shorts and a t-shirt, his pistol and a Lancer copy of the pre-war DeSantis gunny sack fanny pack holster, Darkwood was told to sit down and listen. Cole, a little more presentable looking, sat down as well.
A rare opportunity has presented itself to us, gentlemen. You two are the best men available for the job at hand, so it is yours. I will make this meeting exceedingly brief, as I assume that you will both have a few things to do before your flight leaves. There is a significant rift in the organization that has been so painstakingly assembled by Dietrich Zimmer and his late son Martin. This is a chink in the armor of the Eden Nazi Front. We must take advantage of it. You are both familiar with Gruppenführer Groenberg?
Yes, Herr General Oberst.
Good. He is their best man, the toughest of our adversaries, and he has proposed an alliance of an extremely temporary nature, of course. Yet this may be what we need in order to defuse the current crisis.
Excuse me, sir. Aren't we just putting off the inevitable?
Until we are better prepared? Possibly.
Won't they be better prepared, too? By then, I mean.
I do not make such decisions, nor do you, Darkwood. We all follow orders, do we not? You will travel to Eden City. Appropriate travel documents and the like are in readiness so that you should not have any real difficulties in getting around the city. There, you will meet with Kronberg, and he will provide you with the data which should enable us to anticipate Zimmer's current scheme before the elements of it can be realized. Do it. That is all.
It was all, Nauert dismissing them with a flourish of the hand, sitting down again at his desk and turning to his computer console. They stood, walked out, were driven to their BOQs, where their gear was already packed. After quick showers and a change of clothes, they were airborne, landing at a pre-designated landing zone about 50 miles from Eden City. The field was just that, a field, yet it was adequate for the V-stall which brought them in. How they had managed it through the Eden air defense shield, Darkwood was not certain, except that this might also have been part of the fix. A car was waiting for them, and after inspecting it for explosives and monitoring devices, they found neither, they drove to Eden City, using their papers to enter legally. Much of the city was in ruins, and security was tighter than Darkwood had ever seen it. Some fires still burned, but as best Darkwood could tell, the chemical weapons facility, Plant 234, was totally destroyed. The fires looked to be from downed aircraft and surface-to-air missiles, all due to Eden weapons systems, not those of the Transglobal Alliance. They stopped at the appointed doorway. It was a private apartment building, quite well-to-do looking. Two Eden police stood guard at the doorway with energy rifles. Darkwood and Cole presented their security passes. They bore Kronberg's own signature and were admitted to the foyer. Darkwood rang the appropriate bell and stared up into the video monitor. It would either remain black, or, if the person on the other end were so inclined, show a picture. There was a picture. The face was Kronberg's face.
Do not identify yourselves. I recognize you both. You are admitted. Take the elevator to the 40th floor.
Which apartment?
The 40th floor is the apartment, gentlemen.
I knew that. That he had the whole 40th floor.
Bullshit, as you say.
Fuck you, as you say.
The elevator doors opened the instant Manfred Kohl pushed the call button, and James Darkwood entered first, his pistol drawn.
What good will a handgun do if this is a trap, James?
Beats me. Force of habit.
But James Darkwood didn't put the pistol away. Distrusting Nazis was a habit, too. John Rourke looped the garrote over the sentry's head, then wheeled and snapped the sentry up onto his back. Rourke slowly eased the dead man to the snow, leaving the wire where it was, unsheathing his knife as he moved along the side of the outermost tent. There were 7 tents in all, one for hospital use, one for command and communications, one for field repairs, the remaining 4 for personnel. Rourke's observations of the encampment had confirmed this almost too easily. He kept moving, 2 of the German long-range mountain patrol commandos and 2 of the SEALs with him. At the front of the tent, Rourke signaled a halt. An ordinary soldier, not even Alpine Corps, was passing about 10 yards away, too much in the open for Rourke to get to him without an alarm being raised. Rourke drew the suppressor-fitted 9mm from his belt. This was all but immoral, penetrating this camp so easily. The men who had been left here staked out like goats left to bait a wild predator into a trap. Was that their true function? The aircraft, well beyond the encampment, looked safe enough, but about 3 dozen men had begun advancing on it almost at the same instant Rourke and his personnel had begun their infiltration. This left the encampment even more poorly manned. In about 3 or 4 minutes, as Rourke judged it, the troops advancing on the aircraft would be in position for an assault, their obvious intention. But they were all afoot. Why were the armored half-tracks still parked in the encampment's motor pool? None of this made any sense, except that there was danger here, more than he could fathom. The soldier stopped walking, took cigarettes from the pocket of his parka, and pulled down the lower portion of the toque covering his face.
Shit.
The soldier fired his cigarette with a lighter. As he did so, his face turning toward the side of the tent where Rourke and the 4 commandos waited. There was no choice. Rourke looked toward the troops advancing on the aircraft. They were nearly in position.
We go tent to tent. Move it!
The 2 SEALs fell out, their knives going to work on the tent wall. Rourke and the 2 Germans running around toward the front of the tent. There was no guard. Rourke stepped through the flap opening, the 2 Germans at his heels. No one was inside the tent except the 2 SEALs who had just cut their way in.
Next one!
Rourke wheeled toward the opening, running now for the next tent. If someone appeared, he'd shoot. There was no time for anything else. He saw no sign of enemy personnel between this tent and the next.
Same method.
The 2 SEALs going to the side of the tent, Rourke himself and the 2 Germans going to the front. No guard, no one inside.
Deaton, Hines, hit the hospital tent and watch it. Remember, we don't make war on the wounded. Watch out for the other teams. Paul's men and mine will be moving about the encampment as well.
As Rourke started toward the command tent, he saw Paul Rubinstein already coming out of it. Rourke quickened his pace, joining Paul just outside.
Nothing inside but a tech with a bump on his head. He's gagged and bound, hand and foot with duct tape.
Duct tape?
Like the carry-on aircraft.
Any other personnel?
2 sentries gone. What's going on?
I don't know. Get your men.
Rourke turned toward the 2 German commandos.
Get our people. Come on, hurry up. Then the 2 of you position yourselves on the west end of the camp.
Rourke looked back to Paul Rubinstein.
Put 2 of your men on the eastern boundary. The rest of us are attacking that force moving up on the aircraft. There's still better than 2 minutes before Commander Washington's men are going into action.
After setting out more guards to watch the site of the encampment, he had 6 men remaining, including Paul. The 7 of them removed the guards at the motor pool, 2 men who surrendered without any resistance and used flex cuffs to bind the men. Then, Rourke, Paul, and the others, SEALs and long-range mountain patrol commandos, each selected a vehicle. The vehicles were half-tracked armored Arctic Cats, each of them equipped with energy cannons which could be targeted and fired by the vehicle operator. John Rourke sat at the controls, very similar to those of an ordinary vehicle. The transmission was automatic, but could be manually operated as well. Tracks and wheels each had independent drivers. Field of view was extraordinarily good through video monitors, which covered the 4 cardinal directions as relevant to the vehicle's orientation. And through 2 additional cameras, which covered the airspace above. All 6 cameras were constantly displayed, and the vehicle operator could select the field of view that he wished displayed on the main screen directly in front of the controls. Whichever field of view was chosen, the energy cannon's targeting computer was instantly online. John Rourke was reminded of the old expression concerning shooting fish in a barrel. This would be that. Whatever Dietrich Zimmer's plan was, and John Rourke was certain that there was one, it gave no sympathy to the Nazi personnel who would die in these pre-dawn hours in what was once northwestern Canada. Foot soldiers would be no match for these vehicles. John Rourke started the armored half-track from the motor pool area and across the encampment. The other six vehicles fell in, flanking him.
This is Rourke. In less than 30 seconds, Commander Washington's frontal assault will begin. So I'm assuming he's aware of the situation with the aircraft and will act accordingly. Needless to say, let's watch out for friendly faces and get all the rest.
Rourke spun the wheel into a tight right and turned out directly behind the three dozen Nazis comprising the assault force, the six other vehicles still flanking him. It was time for these men to die, and he doubted they were doing anything else but following incomprehensible orders. Rourke started his vehicle, his main vid screen on forward, the target computer already acquiring.
Spread out. Paul, to the far left. Lieutenant Johnson to my far right. Crescent-shaped formation, each vehicle 50 yards apart.
Rourke, at the very center of the crescent, cut back on his speed, the two men directly flanking him doing the same. Rourke cut back still further, while the half-tracks on the far sides of the crescent increased speed proportionately. The attack on the aircraft was beginning, the flashes of energy rifles lighting the night sky, but the only heavy energy weapons coming from the aircraft itself. The bulk of enemy fire seemed to be concentrated on the wings of the Vistal cargo lifter, as if to disable the craft were the ultimate objective. Why? Three men, a fire team, were beneath his bullseye array on the target computer, and Rourke actuated the weapon, firing a series of energy bursts at the center of the target mass, all but vaporizing the three men.
God help us. This is wrong.
But these men had orders. There was no choice. Six men coming obliquely toward the aircraft cargo bay. John Rourke fired. Six men dead. He kept to his vector, the crescent formation encompassing the entire field now. The enemy personnel were helpless to stop them.
Even as we speak, gentlemen, a battle rages many miles north and west of here in an attempt by Dietrich Zimmer to consummate his greatest goal, to obtain the help of John Rourke in the conquest of Earth.
I don't understand, Colonel.
James Darkwood was very pleased to be sitting here, sipping fine brandy, smoking as good a cigar as could be obtained at any price. Manfred Kohl sipped brandy but didn't smoke.
How could Dr. Zimmer hope to get Dr. Rourke to cooperate with him? That doesn't make any sense at all, Colonel.
Gruppenführer Kroenberg leaned back into his easy chair, swirling his brandy in the glass he held at eye level.
There is a science to everything, gentlemen, whether it be war or race or the making of brandy.
Racial theory is a pile of shit, totally groundless. Sure, skin colors, some characteristics are different, but so what? There's nothing to suggest that one race is superior to another.
Exactly. But race is a convenient excuse, is it not? You see, anyone of even modest intelligence realizes that all human beings are exactly alike in the most basic sense. Each human being is an individual in the broadest sense. There is no more difference between a black man and a white man, or a Jew or a Chinese, than there is between two men of the same race.
You are a Nazi, Herr Gruppenführer. For you to admit that is heretical.
So? Do not misunderstand me, my young friend. What I say to you here, and what I say in order to achieve the ends I seek, will be totally different. Dietrich Zimmer truly believes that his so-called Aryan race is superior. Do you know what the word Aryan really refers to?
A language group, right?
Exactly. Aryan people, if indeed they exist, are those whose native language is Indo-European. None of us remembers, of course, but in the days before the night of the war, there was far greater ethnic diversity. I believe there are a few actual persons possessed of Indian blood from the Indian subcontinent, who still exist among the United States population, but there were millions of them. Some were very light-skinned, some as dark as Africans. This is why the entire idea of Aryan racial conformity is so absurd, of course. These men and women, many of whom looked black, were just as Aryan as the Nordic stereotypes, the blonde-haired and blue-eyed supermen Adolf Hitler so worshipped. Doubly curious, I have always thought, since Hitler himself was rather dark and somewhat swarthy. At any event, Dietrich Zimmer genuinely believes in his theories of race.
What does he want with Dr. Rourke?
Well, you must consider, Darkwood, that I am not your ally, merely Dietrich Zimmer's enemy. So, for a short while, we will be allies. Then we will be enemies again.
I know that.
Tell us, Herr Gruppenführer.
Dr. Zimmer, as his supporters and enemies alike would agree, is a genius. He is, alas, also quite insane. But that does not diminish the genius part of him. Dr. Zimmer wishes to be master of the Earth.
And you don't?
I wish to be master of only a part of the Earth. I, as did Zimmer, in fact, realized some time ago that without an enemy, there is no means by which to exert power. There must be opposing forces, each perceived by the other as evil, but each perceived by itself as good. I wish to control one such force. Zimmer, and this is why he is so particularly dangerous to us all, wishes to control both good and evil. If he could, he would be master of Earth. If he is not stopped, that goal will be achieved, and John Rourke will help him.
John Rourke might kill him.
Only if given the chance. A question. Is Martin Zimmer dead?
I'm not...
At liberty to discuss that, Herr Darkwood? I intentionally left Martin Zimmer to die not long ago in Hawaii. I wanted him dead because he is even worse than his father. The desire for power is there, but not tempered by genius, only baser emotions. I thought that I had succeeded. I learned, through the efforts of a highly placed agent of my personal employ, that Martin Zimmer lives.
What you're saying, Colonel, is it relevant?
Oh, indeed. I see that Allied intelligence knows nothing about this. Fascinating.
Nothing about what, Colonel?
Unlike my adversary, I am not insane, nor do I wish to be God. He is, he does, Zimmer. He has perfected the process by which human beings can be replicated, cloned. He has also perfected the means by which the electromagnetic impulses of the human brain can be recorded and transferred from one brain to another. That means, gentlemen, that he can copy whomsoever he chooses and use that person to his own will however he wishes. There would be no way to tell the difference. Fingerprints, retinal prints, DNA scans, they would all show that the subject was just who he or she claimed to be. You or I, your president or doctor, anyone could be duplicated, then controlled by Dietrich Zimmer. Picture what it would be like if the leaders of both sides were led by one man, served one intelligence, obeyed one will. That, my young friends, would be the ultimate power. The good Dr. Zimmer wields such power, and that is precisely why I speak with you now. If there is God, such is his power alone. For a man to possess this is dangerous beyond understanding.
His daughter's arms around his neck, his son's right hand in his, Natalia's eyes beaming toward him, John Rourke experienced an increasingly rare feeling of total peace. Kissing Annie, hugging Natalia, hugging his son, Annie back in Paul's arms, John Rourke leaned against the aircraft bulkhead.
This is a setup of some kind, and I'm not sure what.
I uncovered some data you need to see, Dad. Total force strength reports for Zimmer's headquarters and a report on cloning and the recording of the human mind.
Wolfgang Mann was with us, as you may recall. But it wasn't Wolf. Just a clone pre-programmed to obey Dr. Zimmer, bearing explosives inside its body, probably in the large intestine, and ready to self-destruct in order to do Zimmer's bidding. What you're saying, Michael, only confirms our own suspicions. And the fact that you got this data from a field computer?
Yes.
That only means that Zimmer wants us to know what he's doing, is offering us an irresistible invitation. He knows what we're thinking, that if Wolfman could be cloned, so could your mother. He wants all of us inside his headquarters complex.
We're going, then.
Oh, yeah, we're going. All of us. And I think it would be stupid to bring any of Commander Washington's men or any of the men from the commando units Paul and I brought with us. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. Zimmer wants us all together, in his lair, alive and well, at least to begin with. Hence this self-destructive military operation, all the data he's kindly provided us. I think it would be awfully rude of us not to accept such an invitation. And anyway, it seems like that'll be the only way we can find out about your mother, Michael. Annie. No one has to go, though. This might be the end, the last of everything. You all know me well enough to know that I've got a bit of an ego. I always like to think I can outsmart our opponents. I think this time, however, we're up against someone who's at least a little smarter than any of us. So far, he's gotten us to do exactly what he wants and probably just on schedule. Before I came in, I stood outside for a long time just watching the sky, trying to fathom what it is that Dietrich Zimmer has in mind. And I can't think it out. Anyone who thinks he or she has an inkling of what's in store for us, for God's sake, speak now.
You know we're with you wherever you go, John. It's always been that way, and it'll always be that way as long as we live. And I agree. We don't know what it is Zimmer has in store, but we don't have any choice but to walk right into his trap.
I suggest we make whatever preparations are necessary, then strike out for Zimmer's assumed headquarters. We'll leave the commandos outside to watch our back, so all we'll have to worry about is inside the complex itself.
What is it like, John?
The structure is built partially within and partially atop a mountain of jagged gray granite, snow splotched here and there, great sheets of ice within the crevices dotting the mountain face. Within, the complex bespeaks solidness. Only the best materials, only the best construction, marble, granite, brass. In many ways, it's what you'd expect. I only saw the main level, not the ones above or the ones below. I don't know what the layout is, nor do I know the defense system. I'm sure we'll get inside easily enough. Perhaps find Sarah just as easily, and maybe Wolfgang Mann, too. It's getting out that worries me. He knows the plan, and we don't. He's the one in charge, and all we can do is play it out until we know his game. I'll admit it, guys. I'm outclassed.
You could never be outclassed, John. He may have the plan. He may have us following it because we have no choice. But he could never surpass you. You may not understand that as well as we do, but it's true. We've been with you since this started, and we'll be with you until it ends. No matter what Dietrich Zimmer did, he could never match what you have done. He might win, and I am not denying that. I think we all try to look at things realistically, but he could never best you. I have read your Bible. Lucifer and his dark angels could never best the forces of light. Even if you die, John, a man like Zimmer would not win.
I have no idea what I ever did to deserve a family like I have. No man could ask for better friends, for a finer son or daughter than I have. I know that someday you and Michael will bring me grandchildren, and that's magnificent beyond belief. And Annie, you and Paul, too. Soon, if we survive these days, my wife will be restored to me in one way or the other. But I don't believe that things will ever be the way they could have been, should have been. And I'm sorry for that, sorry beyond measure. Now, all we can do is try to do our best and hope that our best will be good enough.